On this week's 51%, we sit down with author Theo Boyd to discuss her book, My Grief Is Not Like Yours, and various forms that grief can take.
The most memorable moments for me early on in my grief are when somebody would just come and sit with me and let me talk if I wanted to, or not talk if I didn't want to. You can just be present with them. It's that simple.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us, I'm Jesse King. Last week, we spoke with author and recovery advocate Jessica Hoppe in recognition of Recovery Month. The month of September is also used to increase awareness of mental health and suicide prevention efforts nationwide. Just as Hoppe used writing to explore the history of substance abuse in her family, today's guest has been exploring the impacts of grief and suicide on hers. Theo Boyd is a former teacher, preacher's daughter, and self-described farm girl from Whitney, Texas, who experienced a string of life-altering losses starting in 2019. That summer, Boyd received a call that her mother had died in a tractor crash on their family farm and that her father had been the driver. The grief and guilt felt by her father contributed to him ending his own life 3 years later. And in between, Boyd was also forced to grapple with the pain of her husband's affair, their divorce, and the death of her trusted therapist. Boyd's book, called My Grief Is Not Like Yours, is an attempt to process the deaths of her loved ones and those 3 hard years. Combining personal stories and advice from mental health professionals, Boyd offers comfort to those who also find themselves in the throes of complicated grief. Just a warning that today's episode features a discussion on suicide, which might be upsetting for some listeners.
It was May the 9th, 2023, when my book released. I felt like I was naked in front of the world. I woke up and thought, what have I done? I have put all my innermost feelings during my grief into a book that I'm allowing the world to read. But it went away quickly. That feeling went away quickly when I got responses and people coming to me at book events saying how much it helped them. So I realized that putting my vulnerability into this book healed me. It helped to heal me, but it actually is helping others. So regular grief, I like to describe it as you take off work, you go to the funeral, you're a little bit sad, you may go back to work the next day or you may take a day off, but your life pretty much stays normal. Grief is a normal process for the body. It is just a normal thing that we all go through at some point, whether we're grieving a job, a relationship, a pet, a human. But complicated grief is a disruption in that normal grieving process. And I first heard the word in my counselor's office 6 days after my mother's funeral. My counselor, her name is Gail, I share a lot of Gailisms in my book. I actually dedicate an entire chapter to Gail and what she taught me, and so that I can pass that on to other people. And she was such a phenomenal person. And then, of course, she dies suddenly right after my complicated grief training. But she was counseling my dad and I, and how she explained it to me is complicated grief. You don't remember where you were to go back to work. You don't, your equilibrium is completely shattered. Your life shuts down. And the week of my mom's funeral, I remember being on an ATV at our farm, just trying to get away and smell the air and kind of clear my mind. And I ran into a plow that was hidden under the weeds and I busted my elbow open and had to go get stitches. And the next day I backed my car into my sister's car in the driveway. My whole sense of being was off. And so complicated grief is a disruption in the normal grieving process. Your brain cannot wrap your mind around what has happened. And it's like a compass with a broken needle. You can picture that, can't you? A compass and the needle is just going every which way. And you're trying to find your way again. And you have to talk to a counselor that is trained in complicated grief counseling or in your specific type of loss. That is critical to healing, to get back on the road and get your compass going, right.
That must be so hard to do. You know, there's like, even seeking out resources when you're in a brain fog like that.
And that's what's crazy. I didn't realize what I was doing was part of the grief until my counselor said, well, you've got complicated or complex grief, which is now known as prolonged grief disorder, PGD. And I've recently heard from some people at hospice that the APA has actually said you can't be diagnosed with complicated grief or PGD until you've had it for 12 months. And I really hope that that changes, because I was diagnosed just 2 weeks after my mom's death. And I don't know what I would have done had I not been given that diagnosis early on. Because when you know there's a name for it, you feel like you belong. You feel like you're not alone. I realized when there was a name for it, and I even talk about this in detail in my book, you know, I was writing it on my little notepad in my counselor's office, C-O-M-P-L-I-C-A-T-E-D, complicated grief. This makes sense. I don't have what just, you know, because I've had a lot of people come up to me early on in my grief. Well, when I lost my mom, I did this. And when I lost, which is really the reason that I titled the book, My Grief Is Not Like Yours, because early on in my grief, well-intentioned friends and family and the grievers that are listening out there, you know what I'm talking about. They're offering you a comparison and trying to help, bless their heart. But what that does to a fresh griever is just push them further into their darkness, and you feel unheard in your grief. So that is why I wrote the book. I did not write the book, Jesse, so that people would just read about my grief. I wrote the book so that people could own that title for themselves and have an outlet for their grief and a way to heal. And that's why I put questions in the book for the reader to journal in their own pain on the pages. And I just was hoping that if I was feeling this way, maybe I can help others that have been feeling this way.
Well, I guess that kind of goes into one of my next questions, because, you know, you focus a lot in the book about how no two people grieve the same way. After the death of your mother, did you see yourself grieving differently from your family members even at that time, even though you were all grieving the same person?
Yes, and I talk about that. I think it's in chapter 3. I was angry when people were eating. You know, Texas, my parents were peanut farmers. We live in Hill County, Texas, and the community really showed up with just tons of food, coming over to the house, trying to console my dad. And for those of you that don't know the story, my grief started July 29th, 2019. I learned that my father had accidentally run over my mom with one of the farm tractors, and they would have been married 50 years. We were just 6 months away from their anniversary celebration. So rather than planning for that, we had to transition and start planning for my mom's funeral. But the community showed up with food, hugs and love. And I was angry when I would see people at the house eating, because I could not eat. I think I lost 23 pounds in a month. I could not eat. My mom was such a phenomenal cook. And I thought, if I can't eat her cooking and she can't enjoy this food, then I'm not going to either. Now, my sister was the opposite of that. She was eating everything that people brought. That's how she was comforting herself. So yes, everybody was different. But of course, in the book, I just write about what my experience was. And then I have a chapter called The D Diets, and that's death, divorce, and discovery. So my mom died. That was the very first domino to fall, so to speak. That was July 29th, 2019. Then a few months after that, I learned my husband had been having an affair, and I started to go through another grief, which is divorce, which I also talk about in my book. And that hits you just as hard, because the one person you thought you could count on is the one you could count on the least. Mm-hmm. And then a few months after that, my counselor died suddenly that had been counseling my dad and I through complicated grief. And I was like, God, what is going on? And the last chapter, so to speak, was 2022, Father's Day morning. I went to check on my dad to take him breakfast and surprise him for Father's Day. And I found that he had taken his life. And that was 3 years after the horrible accident. So he stayed with us for 3 years. And I thought, you know, early on, I was very aware that he might do something like that because his grief was so great and heavy. But I'd kind of dropped my guard after 3 years. So that really took me back and dropped me to my knees again. But with each grief, I found my way up And how I did that was chapter 11. It's called More F Words. And I tell people all the time, get more F words in your vocabulary. And I'm talking about friends, faith, fun, fellowship, and my foundation. I had the best childhood on the farm with the strongest of mother and father figures. But I realized there's people out there in the audience, they're grieving, going through something horrible, and they don't have the foundation that I had. So I'm using my voice to help them get through a dark time when they don't have that ability to speak up for their grief. So I'm trying to be, would you say stronger for those that are weaker in this moment because of my history and my mom and dad and what they, brought me up to be? My dad was a minister in the community for 33 years. So I watched him help other people when they needed it. So I feel like I'm carrying on their legacy in the book and trying to help others.
That's great to hear that, you've reached this point where you feel like you can pour from your cup and help others. When you were in it, though, you still do have to take care of yourself in some way. How do you go about nurturing and helping yourself?
Some wise Gaelisms, my counselor, the first thing she said to me is be kind to yourself, be gentle with yourself. And I didn't know what she was talking about. I was like, what do you need me to go to a spa day? Do you want me to go get a massage? And now I know 100% what she meant. She was telling me to not be so hard on myself. If you can't get out of bed one day, that's okay. It is okay. Give yourself grace in grief. And we don't do that enough. We are so hard on ourselves. And I think, especially in America, with a society that really doesn't allow you to grieve, I think we feel pressured to just get back out there and do what we have always done. But I'm going to be the first one to tell you, you don't have to. If you want to stay in bed all day, it's okay. Guess what? God's going to give us another day tomorrow and we can try again. But there were times that it's not just one day at a time. It's not 1 hour at a time. It's not 1 minute at a time. It was 1 second at a time to try to get through life. You feel like you're walking through peanut butter. You feel like you're walking with a backpack filled with bricks. You just feel dark and heavy. And I mean, forget a black cloud. It's a bucket of black paint that's been poured on you like tar. And until that starts to dry, where you can start chipping it away, you won't see any light until you can get that to start chip away. And then the little light shines through. And that light is hope. By sharing, we belong. And by belonging, we can share. And I just feel like it's very important that we, once again, as a society, start to help each other. Nobody's getting out of this thing alive, this life thing. So we've all got to be there for each other while we're here.
In your case, though, it had to have been difficult to do that while grieving yourself. So I guess, what was it like caring for your father and your family after your mother's death? Were you ever angry at having to do that, given the situation?
I learned early on, the very night of my mom's death, that my dad was not going to be able to comfort me and my sister. And I guess I was a little shocked, but then I had to realize the enormity of his loss. And he, a minister, was cursing God. He was saying words I've never heard him say. I was 47 years old, and I can tell you, 47 years, I'd never heard him say these words. And I was frightened. I was a frightened little girl. And I text my counselor, and she texted me right back. And, I'd had her, she and I'd been friends for 18 years, and she'd helped me through some minor life things, but never something as great as this. But she texted me back and said, let him say the words that he needs to say. Those are the words that carry the weight of his pain. And we've got to allow grievers to say and do what they need to do, even if we think it's odd. But I'm not saying go into a room full of kindergartners and start cursing, but I'm saying if you've got a loved one that's grieving in a heavy way, just know that it's a normal process for the body to do things that it never would have done before because it's that coping mechanism. It's the only way that it knows how. So that really helped me, but it was very hard for me to grieve my mom with taking care of my dad. And I don't know if there's people listening that have that situation. You've lost one parent and you're taking care of the other. You don't want to grieve so heavy in front of them and make them feel worse. And especially in my dad's situation, pretty much, having blood on his hands, so to speak, he felt such enormous guilt. So we just spent a lot of time comforting him, a lot of time with my counselor early on. and letting him know that it was a freak accident and, accidents happen and that we loved him. Nobody blamed him. And I didn't have the luxury of silencing my grief with blame because knowing now what I know about grievers, it is easier to feel anger than to feel sadness. So they will quickly lash out with anger and blame rather than the grief, because they would just rather have something to blame than something to grieve. So looking back, I know I handled it in a way that I'm proud to say I did, because I never blamed him. I only tried to comfort him. I took family leave from the high school where I was teaching because we were early in the school year when this happened. And I had the first 6 to 8 weeks, I believe, of 2019 to live with my dad and just make sure he could get back on his feet and make sure he was okay. So I'm so blessed to have had that.
We're speaking with Theo Boyd, author of My Grief Is Not Like Yours. You mentioned earlier that you had had hints that your dad was having suicidal thoughts early on after your mother's death. But by like the 2 or 3 year mark, it had seemed like he was maybe handling the situation better. I guess, what do you feel people commonly misunderstand about suicide? Because it's certainly a topic that doesn't get discussed a lot, so I think there's got to be a gap between how we might understand it and what families out there are actually experiencing.
We do shy away from it. And I will admit, the morning after I found my dad and all my friends had come and we were planning the funeral, there was a part of me that thought, I can't tell anyone. And I'm shocked that I'm a pretty open person. I'm shocked that I even had that feeling that I couldn't tell anybody that daddy committed suicide or, took his life. But I realized just very quickly after that, probably just a few minutes, no, my parents were about truth. They always believed in completely telling the truth. And I know God will give you more than you can handle. You hear people say all the time, God won't give you more than you can handle, but that's not even biblical. I'm a preacher's daughter and I can tell you that. What he will do is he may give you more than you can handle, but it's still part of his plan. And I think for suicide families out there, of course, you didn't feel like it was going to happen. Early on, I got more than a hint that my dad could do that because he literally told the sheriff that night that he wanted to take his life. So we had to be with him 24/7 for several weeks, and then the counseling, and we had to show the counseling. And number one thing for somebody to do if they think a loved one is, if there's a possibility, the number one thing is to talk to someone that is trained specifically in whatever that thing is that they're going through, that depression or that sadness. Talk to somebody that is trained in that type of counseling. That is critical. And you might be thinking, no, they're not going to, or they're not, I can't get them there. If you can go yourself, you're going to get a tool that's going to help you to be better with them. And if you only can get one thing out of a 1 hour session, go get that one thing. Because I'll be honest, when I was going into counseling just a few days after my mom's funeral, there were not many things I remembered. And I could not even think to write something down. I would honestly come away with just one thing that I remembered out of a 1 hour session. And it was probably the most important thing because it stuck in my brain. And then the next time I'd go, the next week, I'd get one more thing. And then pretty soon, after so many weeks, guess what? You've got an arsenal of things that you can use in your toolbox to help other people and to help yourself. And that's why in the book, I share those things that I learned. So that's the number one thing, is to find someone to talk to. And if you can't get the person you're worried about to talk to somebody, then you go talk to somebody.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, a few years ago, I started volunteering at a crisis center, partially because I wanted to help, but also because I just wanted more knowledge about how to talk to someone in those critical moments. Because, I do have people in my own life who have struggled with their mental health. And in the event any of them came to me, I guess I wanted not to feel comfortable, because I don't think it's ever a comfortable conversation, but I just wanted a better idea of how to understand them and how to check in on people. Because I think, like you said, sometimes someone's not going to go out and seek help themselves. So you want to at least be kind of a safe harbor for them.
You can pray that they will. You can just keep praying and hope that God can move that in their life. But you can there's only so much that you can do, and you're not responsible for another person's emotions. You're not responsible for how they react or handle a situation. But what you are 100% responsible for is you. So you went and did that, and you got better equipped to help others. And just like learning a foreign language, they tell you the best way is immersion. Go to be in that country and learn that language by being fully immersed in it. And it's the same with grief and helping others. Get immersed in it. Unfortunately, I was immersed beyond my control, and I was baptized by fire, so to speak. So I had to learn, but I'm so thankful now that I feel like I have this knowledge of humanity now I feel that I didn't have before. And I'm so passionate about it that I'm actually conducting a research study of grief right now with a company out of Austin, Texas. That's going to be coming out in January, and I'm going to be putting a lot of that research and its findings in my second book because I want to know what's going on with suicide in America. What's going on with grief in America? What's the state of grief in America? Why are we putting the gag order on grief?
You mentioned earlier that you debated whether or not to even tell anyone that your father took his own life. I don't know from experience, but I do think that that's a common fear for families, just, that stigma that's around it and whether or not to tell people or even include it in something like an obituary.
I struggled with that, and I had some friends say, no, I wouldn't say that, but I just wanted people to know. I wanted them to know the enormity of his pain because that showed the enormity of his love for my mom. To me, it's a beautiful love story. When I'm at a book event and they come up and say, what is your book about? I'll say, well, I saw you looking at rom-coms over there, and my book actually does have a lot of funny parts because my dad was a very funny individual, but it's a beautiful love story. And I wish that obituaries did say, I wish we could just be open enough to say that, because I feel by not saying that, we're trying to hide something. We need to honestly address it and hit it head on and say what it is so that we can kind of move on and maybe be a society where there's not as many suicides happening.
Well, Theo, thanks so much for sharing with me. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask, what do you remember most about your parents? How do you remember them today?
My mother was deaf. She was profoundly deaf from the age of 18 months old. She lost her hearing to a high fever. She learned not sign language, but she learned how to communicate at the age of 10. So until the age of 10, she did not speak. She only communicated with body language and hand gestures, but she did at the age of 10 learn to communicate, and she actually spoke and had a wonderful, successful life after she learned how to write and read. And so what I tell people all the time is, you wonder what you can do for a grieving individual. What can I do? What can I say? What can I get them? The number one most important thing you can do for a griever is just to be present. My dad was a very tall, 6'4", charismatic individual. When he entered a room, you knew he was there. He commanded the room. He was the Charles Ingalls, I like to say, of Hill County. My mom was quiet, soft, gentle. She was kind of taking up a very subtle section of space. And we would get back from an event where my dad would be the guest speaker, and he would be, you would think he would have known everything, right? He would look at my mom and say, Sue, that was my mom's name. And he'd say, who is that? And what was that? And do you remember that? And my mom knew every single thing that happened in that room, who was there, what they said, and what went on. She could not hear a thing but 5% with her hearing aid on. Yet she knew everything that was going on because she was an expert at being in the room and being present. And I have a chapter in my book called In the Room, where I talk about their presence and how important it is to be present. And how I was present with my mom the last time in the room at the funeral home. But I think we need to stop thinking it's some big grand thing we've got to do or say, when the most memorable moments for me early on in my grief are when somebody would just come and sit with me and be with me and let me talk if I wanted to, or not talk if I didn't want to. So don't think you've got to do some great thing out there, everybody. You can just be present with them. It's that simple.
That's great. Is there anything else that you hope readers take away from your book?
I have an exercise at the end of the book called 100 Things. because I was feeling unheard in my grief after my mom, I was feeling like she had been forgotten. And so I got a piece of paper out and I just numbered it like 1 to 10, and then it ended up being 100. And I started just writing things about my mom. And I shared this in the book and I tell you how to do it. It's very simple. And I just started writing, my mama loved me. My mama loved daddy. My mama loved the color blue. My mama loved to pick pears. My mama loved to sew. And I just started writing all these things about my mom in no particular order, just top of mind, whatever came out. And all of a sudden, I had 100 things about my mom. And I've had people say to me that they've done that for their daughter that was living and went off to college and sent it to her. So, the 100 things is a very helpful exercise no matter what loss you're going through. And it can be for somebody you haven't lost, just as a nice way to tell them, these are the things I think about when I think about you.
Theo Boyd is the author of My Grief Is Not Like Yours, Learning to Live After Unimaginable Loss, A Daughter's Journey. It's out now through 4Front Books, and you can find it at most major booksellers. You can learn more about Boyd's work at thinktheo.com. Theo, thanks again for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Jesse.
If you or someone you love is in crisis, know that help is available. The National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 by texting or calling 988. You can also chat online at 988lifeline.org. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night, air down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.